Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is Senior Vice President and Clinical Director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Dr. Kavita Patel from the Brookings Institution. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare looks at a telemedicine platform for addiction recovery. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When Jennifer Staple Clark was a sophomore at Yale, an internship at the ophthalmology office turned out to be a life-transforming experience. She realized that many of the patients who had limited access to medical care were coming into the office with serious eye conditions that had gone past the point of reversing, leading to unnecessary blindness. What she launched from her dorm room 11 years ago was a local initiative to improve access to preventative eye care to the neediest population in her local community. Her vision quickly grew. Within 2 years, she took her organization, Unite for Sight, worldwide and has since turned it into one of the leading providers of global eye care in hundreds of communities around the world. Unite for Sight brings social entrepreneurs, public health experts, local eye surgeons, and volunteers together to bring eye care into some of the most underserved areas of the world. The motto at Unite for Sight is that local problems need local solutions, so they use each country's existing pool of ophthalmologists and eye surgeons to treat their local patients. They also train community health workers in each area they serve, thus removing traditional barriers to eye care experienced by many in extreme poverty, and also ensuring a continuum of care for all of the patients they serve. The community health workers provide education and transportation to get doctors to the patients' communities and patients to the hospital if surgery is indicated. Since its inception, Unite for Sight has served 1.4 million patients worldwide and restored eyesight to roughly 55,000 people, restoring not only their sight, but their dignity and ability to be productive members of their communities as well. Identifying a pressing medical need, using global health delivery models, and improving the quality of life by offering basic preventative eye care to those who had previously gone without. Now that's a bright idea. We're speaking today with Dr. Kavita Patel, Managing Director of the Delivery System Reform and Clinical Transformation at the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform at the Brookings Institution. Dr. Patel is also co-chair of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Health Professional Workforce Initiative and co-author of two just-released reports, The Complexity of National Healthcare Workforce Planning and Better Healthcare Worker Demand Projections. She worked in the Obama administration as well as on a committee led by Senator Ted Kennedy in drafting of the Affordable Care Act. She's a practicing primary care physician at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Patel, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much for having me, and please call me Kavita.
Kavita, great. So we're just months away from the implementation of the Affordable Care Act in January 2014, and we'll see tens of millions of uninsured Americans added to the system. So tell us a little bit about why workforce projections are so complex in healthcare and why your reports are so important in helping us understand why the lack of relevant healthcare workforce data is leaving us ill-equipped to meet the coming needs.
Let me just start by telling you that when we were surprised, it was sobering to myself that when you look for supply estimates, just how many healthcare professionals we have in this country, you'll find such a variation from one source to another. And it's because of how we count health professionals. So in some cases, physicians are counted only as primary care doctors and don't necessarily include the specialists. And then in some cases, nurses are people with just an RN. But if you go to some of the nursing societies, they also include people with RNs as well as other advanced degrees like PhDs. And so there was such a wide variety of our estimates that we thought, okay, we need to first do a deeper dive in what are the sources of data, what are the differences in the sources of data, and then we can start to talk about how do we look at a model for what kind of healthcare workers we might need are, for example, the demand of healthcare. And it was, as I mentioned, very sobering to try to understand all the differences between some of these numbers, which made it even more complex.
It seems to me, Kavita, that one of the challenges you have, and I thought you made this point really compellingly in one of your reports, is that we keep piling lots of new data on the top into a model which has the same assumptions staying at the bottom. And you've made the case we really have to change the underlying assumptions if we want to make use of the new data. Can you talk a little bit more about that for our audience?
So let's just take a very basic example. A lot of our data assumptions about what kind of workforce we need are modeled on our current system or old systems of seeing patients in office visits and having it always be a physician who leads that office visit. And we also have used other assumptions about how many doctors you need per 1,000 patients. We've used that model for years, in fact, decades.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, we've since had all these new models of care, patient-centered medical homes, accountable care organizations. We've seen a great proliferation of community health workers, lay health workers, the use of nurse practitioners and physician's assistants in practices. But our model and the way we think about how much care we need still hinges on this very cottage-like industry with a doctor in charge. And that's the assumptions those are the assumptions we use when we start to say, well, there's a shortage, and well, there's a projected shortage. And I think that that's part of what we tried to tackle was, wait a minute, let's not just talk about how we might need one doctor for every, 5,000 people in the country. Let's actually think about what kind of care do 5,000 people need? And then what are the skill sets of the various members of the healthcare team that best suit those needs? And that's almost flipping the equation and saying, what is it that we want to get to? And how do we work backwards to figure out what we need to fulfill that?
You're seeing the fast rise of retail clinics, a lot of different ways that people are delivering care. And you really look at the distinction between patient demand and true healthcare need. How are these needs differing in different socioeconomic groups as well?
We really thought long and hard about how you deal with especially the needs of high-risk populations. Take, for example, the 11 million Medicare dual-eligibles, Medicare, Medicaid dual-eligibles in this country, really high concentration of need. And one thing that we've found is that in modeling our demand side, so we talked about supply a little bit, and I kind of alluded to the demand, that's where the information about subpopulations really comes to play. Instead of getting hung up on kind of the place of care, what we tried to understand, and quite honestly, to be blunt with you, we're just scratching the surface. We need more work in this area. What we found was that instead of looking at the location or site of care, we really need to understand how could care delivery to special populations look differently. We must agree on some standardized data reporting. Mm-hmm. And this means not just on the supply side, but we have to have some standardized reporting on the demand side, especially for populations of special interest.
Well, it seems to me that, again, looking at both supply and demand, one area it seems to me from working at the state level anyway is we don't have any uniformity across states in terms of the kind of data we collect. What's your approach as a national research group looking at this? What's your approach to trying to get states to agree on how to collect data in common and electronically and what the critical elements of data are to collect?
So this is a perfect question because we actually reached out to the National Governors Association, who has been very interested in this exact issue. What are the minimum state data reporting requirements? And we canvassed across the states to try to understand what is it that they currently do, and then how can we effectively give them some recommendations. And they are actually more than willing to adopt a little bit more of a standard approach. I was surprised. I thought, oh, each state is going to have its personalities about what they want to measure, what they think the right thing is. But I was surprised. People said, look, we are overwhelmed. We have no idea what to do about this. We want you to tell us what to do. So what we actually did is we went back and then went to our federal colleagues in the Health Resources and Services Administration, which is tasked with doing some of this work, and through the Affordable Care Act. We actually went back to them and said, listen, can you tell us what you're coming up with in terms of minimum data elements? and how you are recommending those be collected. And then we will take those back to the states. And that's exactly the process that we're in right now. We're actually taking what HRSA has been doing and recommending and saying to the states, we're not telling you have to do this. Here's what the federal government is trying to do. Here's how we could recommend you do this. And the timing could not be better because they are already updating their data collection infrastructure to meet the needs of the expanded Medicaid enrollment and health insurance exchanges. So they're willing to do this, but they just need help. I mean, these are really great people inside the states who are trying to do everything at the same time. So we found that it was best to pair the work going on at the federal level and say, here's the minimum. And health IT plays a big role in this. We're trying to explore right now how to get the best, how we can try to understand some health workforce staffing information based on the health IT systems that are currently deployed across the country.
We're speaking today with Dr. Kavita Patel, Managing Director of the Delivery System Reform and Clinical Transformation at the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform at the Brookings Institution. Dr. Patel served in the Obama administration as the Director of Policy for the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs and Public Engagement and was the Deputy Staff Director for the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee under Senator Ted Kennedy. So lots of exciting opportunities arise out of the Affordable Care Act, and you note this in your report. It's created many new incentives and innovations in healthcare. It's also created some new challenges. You know, walk through for our listeners some of those challenges and how you think we might best meet them.
So I think that some of the challenges that I see on the horizon in terms of also just, as you mentioned, kind of this launch of health reform that's started in 2010, but will really come into full fruition in 2014. But I do think that we are really at a precipice of how can we leverage the data that we have and then these emerging models of care. And when I say emerging models of care, some of you may feel like they're not so emerging. Let's be honest, there are parts of the country where having kind of a patient-centered model is really a different culture than potentially what the status quo has allowed. So one thing I would say is that we walk through this, just give me a little freedom here. As we're thinking about restructuring care differently, and we're thinking about trying to decrease the cost of healthcare, and then we're also looking our patients in the eyes and saying, you know what, I'm going to try to make sure that I give you the best information in as small amount of time as possible, but I will also hope that you take that information and make better decisions from it. So I see this as like a narrative of a kind of a cycle, a life cycle. Then we also have to look at some of these emerging innovation models and say, what are we learning about the kinds of training, the skill sets, and the response from our patients? And then how do we feed that back? I mean, we have a massive infrastructure of education in our country, and we don't talk about it a lot. We talk about health reform a lot. We talk about supply net needs and physician workforce shortages, for example. We don't talk about going in and opening up our classrooms and saying, wait a minute, are we actually training the types of people that we actually want on the receiving end? And I would say to you, there's a great disconnect there. Mm-hmm. So I see this as a great life cycle in a true biological sense. We need to cycle it back. And I think that, to me, that's the narrative that not just this workforce study, but the Bipartisan Policy Center is doing work on cost containment. They're doing work on health IT. Those things have to marry together.
You know, the Affordable Care Act had a number of important provisions that have not yet come to pass. And I noted in your report, you addressed or you listed one of them, which we actually authored around the demonstration grants for family nurse practitioner training programs, which are in there, but not yet appropriated.
Funded,
but much larger than that really is the creation of the National Healthcare Workforce Commission, which I think there was a great deal of excitement about that as a aspect of the Affordable Care Act that would have addressed this need for more centralized data and I think probably would have gone at that connection between education, training, not just to clinical care, but to models of care. And so you've been inside this world. We all know we're seeing a level of divisiveness in Congress. What's your expectation about what will happen with that National Healthcare Workforce Commission? Will that come to fruition? And if not, where else do we go to make this happen at the policy level?
If I start getting bogged down in what Congress can and can't do, I then, just having worked on the inside, it can get pretty depressing. I am optimistic that all the things we're talking about, and by the way, I'm a fan of your program because I think you all do a great job of bringing these complex concepts to people in a very kind of digestible way. I think everything that you've been talking about for months now, quite honestly, is going to come to a head when we've got headlines in 2014 that say, you know, in certain parts of the country, it's hard to find a primary care doctor, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that'll force the issue for people to say, wait a minute, we had this provision in health reform. What happened to it? And then we're really talking about $2 to $3 million for the Workforce Commission to be funded. And that's a lot of money. It's not something I'm dismissing. But in the big picture and the impact it could have, it's a great investment. So I'm optimistic that in the next year, we're going to see enough demand for the information that the commission will have. In the meantime, though, I can't stress enough, one of our lessons that we learned is that we have got to figure out how to leverage the private sector. Mm-hmm. And I know we say that a lot in healthcare, but I'm serious. We are seeing the big insurance companies, big integrated systems like Geisinger, Kaiser, we're seeing them come forward with their own creative data set solutions, models of care, and estimates. We need to take advantage of that. And so while we're waiting for a lovely way to bring it together through the commission, I think we need to go back to some of these leaders in the private sector and say, listen, let's actually think about what the needs could be and what you can teach the rest of the country in terms of what you've found. And then actually let's take that out and show how states like Texas can think about Medicaid expansion and workforce models in a different way.
I really liked it when you took us back to that big picture, looking at the triple aim of the Affordable Care Act to increase access, improve outcomes, and reduce cost. And then sort of this notion of a virtuous cycle, that there are things that are being learned and questioning how they come back to the educational system, because we're seeing, we host a Weizmann Symposium annually at our center, and we bring in sort of the best thinkers from around the country. We had Group Health from out in Washington State, and their model is, look at, one-third of our visits are in person, one-third are on phone, and one-third are by Skype. So there's so many different models happening, and I just really worry that the educational system and our leadership for that next generation of nurse practitioners, physician assistants, physicians, all the allied health providers just aren't ready for prime time, and we are at a point of reinvention and redefinition of how primary care could operate in an optimal setting. What should we be looking out for rays of hope from you?
Let me tell you that I always look for rays of hope in a lot of different payer settings, because we often talk about, Virginia Mason, Group Health, Kaiser, they're in capitated settings. They've got kind of a lovely bubble around them. So I look for things that could actually take advantage of a really amazing care in a fee-for-service setting. So let me give you two examples in Medicare. One is a program in Florida called ChenMed. They take care of pretty much 100% Medicare patients. And they do it in Florida, one of our costliest states. And they do the following. They send out a town car to pick up patients, and they do auto reminders for patients. And these are elderly patients, but we think the elderly don't use technology. They do.
They've got
grandchildren that they talk to on Skype and Facebook more than I do. So they meet the needs of patients that generally cost the system a lot of money, but they meet the needs by dealing with things that don't get reimbursed by Medicare. But what they found is they can actually make money, meaning they're not losing money on this. And they do this kind of wraparound and text reminders about preventive services that are due. And I think that that's an amazing accomplishment in the Miami area. And the second one I'll tell you about is something you may have heard of because he was profiled in one of Atul Gawande's essays. Rishika Fernandopoul started Iora Health. And they take what you're talking about a little bit, Mark, with kind of the pod design, but they take the hotspotters and design a clinic around hotspotters' needs. And they're doing this in Massachusetts, in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and they've just opened all in a Medicaid, Medicare setting, mostly dual eligibles. And they sat and looked at what hotspotters' needs are when they do come to clinic, and they've basically structured an entirely different flow of work to address those needs. And so I think that those are rays of hope because they're entrepreneurial, they're in our current system, which in a large way is somewhat broken financially, but they're doing something and they're making it work financially. So, and what I hope is that I really want Rashika and ChenMed to give us the data on how they've understood the staffing needs for their healthcare and how we can actually go back to some of the top medical schools and nursing schools and allied health worker schools in the country and say, how are we training people to engage and work in these environments?
We've been speaking today with Dr. Kavita Patel, Managing Director of Delivery System Reform and Clinical Transformation at the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform at the Brookings Institution. Dr. Patel is also the co-chair of Bipartisan Policy Center's Health Professional Workforce Initiative, and the co-author of two just-released reports, The Complexities of National Healthcare Workforce Planning and Better Healthcare Worker Demand Projections. You can access these reports and learn more about her work by going to bipartisanpolicy.org. Dr. Patel, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Ariane O'Hare with this tech report. Technology is infiltrating healthcare in a big way. There are apps for doing EKGs on your mobile phone, digital home monitoring systems, and now drug and alcohol addiction recovery in a secure online setting. Lime Rock Recovery is the brainchild of Silicon Valley startup pro Peter Loeb, a veteran of the video game world, having worked in high-level positions at Electronic Arts and Sega. But several close life-threatening brushes with his daughter's addiction and a sister who succumbed to the disease changed his entrepreneurial course.
The education that I got in addiction and its treatment through my family members was pretty profound because, you know, what could be more important than defending your family members, especially your child, against a dreadful threat. And I just wondered if there was a need for it. So it really started as an experiment.
So Loeb thought he might be able to meld his tech know-how with a recovery world and launch the world's first telemedicine platform for online addiction recovery. And with a partner and his now sober daughter, they launched Lion Rock Recovery, a secure, encrypted, online, high-definition video conference recovery system.
The first thing that happens when you come into the program, if you sign up, is that we give you a Lion Rock Recovery email address, and that system is provided to us by a HIPAA-compliant, you know, certified HIPAA-compliant provider, so it's all encrypted, and we then, all of our communications with our clients and between clients and counselors are through this system. Nothing ever leaves.
Loeb thought early adopters would be men who tend to be more drawn to technology, but it turns out more women are signing on for this online rehab service. Though still in startup phase, Lion Rock Recovery is working with several dozen clients in a number of countries and has received accreditation from the prestigious Joint Commission, something only 6% of rehab facilities around the country have received.
They went through all of our stuff, you know, in terms of our procedures and our, you know, our HIPAA compliance, and then they sat in on group and spoke to our counselors and spoke to our clients. All online, as a matter of fact.
Loeb says Lion Rock Recovery isn't for everyone. You have to feel comfortable interacting in a tech environment, but it appears to be a good primer for folks who've been reluctant to start any kind of treatment.
From time to time, and in our practice, we've discovered that we are prehab. We've had two or three clients start with us saying that they can't possibly join a support group. They can't possibly go to treatment. And by the time they're finished with our program, they've both joined a support group, and we've had a couple go off to residential treatment. Sometimes we're the training wheels that they need just to get started on the road to recovery.
You can find out more about Peter Loeb and Lion Rock Online Recovery by going to lionrockrecovery.com. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter or would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.